The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. The issue of Time Magazine, from which I will begin reading, is dated November 8/November 15, 2021, bordered in red, as usual, with a white inner border, a background of pale blue, upon which is a portrait of John Kerry, the diplomat, dressed in a blue suit, white shirt, and blue and white patterned tie. He looks directly at the lens of the camera. With silvery gray hair and quite a quantity of it, pale blue eyes. Time itself is in white, large block letters, superimposed upon the light blue background. It is possible that I will return to an older edition of Time from October 11/October 18, 2021, featuring the portrait of Jane Goodall on the cover. But now to the Time edition dated November 8/November 15, 2021, and beginning with an article entitled, Economy, They Quit. Now what? This is by Raisa Bruner, B-R-U-N-E-R. Young people are leaving their jobs in record numbers and not going back. Life for Whitney Green looks a little different these days. She wakes up to the sounds of Rome, scooter engines echoing off cobblestones, the lilting chatter of cafe patrons collecting their morning espresso shots. She goes to Italian classes in the afternoons. She eats bowls of pistachio gelato and handmade pasta and watches tourists congregate at Trevi Fountain and Piazza Navona. She's teaching herself to play keyboard and building a website for her dream job, her own telehealth practice. It is a far cry from her past life as a community mental health therapist for at-risk youth in San Francisco, a job she quit in June to move to Italy with her girlfriend. Green is one of millions of Americans leaving traditional jobs this year and choosing not to recommit to clocking in at all. This is the highest mass resignation the U.S. has seen since 2019, pre-pandemic. The numbers are still rising. In June, 3.9 million quit. In July, it was another 3.9 million. In August, 4.3 million. The numbers are even more notable for young workers. In September, nearly a quarter of workers ages 20 to 34 were not considered part of the U.S. workforce. Some, 14 million Americans, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who were neither working nor looking for work. For some, it is burnout. For others, the timing was ripe to refocus on side projects as the stresses of the pandemic started to wane. And for many, especially in a service sector dominated by Zillennials, those in their late 20s on the border of Gen Z and Millennial, poor treatment and low wages became unsustainable. Green represents one slice of that. She is a 31-year-old with a master's degree who decided to step back from earning income to take a self-imposed sabbatical and live off savings before working for herself one day. Meanwhile, there are an estimated 10.4 million jobs in the U.S. that remain unfilled, as this exodus, dubbed the Great Resignation, offers young workers time to nurse the wounds of pandemic burnout and untenable working conditions with dramatic life changes. This is a revolution, not a resignation, says Ifeoma Ezimato, 23, who resides in Washington, D.C. A former hospitality worker and bartender, Ezimako was fed up with ill-tempered patrons and extra-low wages while working her last service job in March 2020. She'd worked in service 5 years, but enough was finally enough. As the behavior of customers deteriorated during the pandemic, she and her co-workers opened their eyes to the daily injustices of tipped work, she says. A common experience, being asked to pull her mask down so patrons could see her face to decide how much to tip. To her, the money just was not worth the stress. She quit to refocus on herself, studying for a sociology degree with her family's support. Now she volunteers with One Fair Wage, an activist organization that helps service and industry employees organize for better standards. The leisure and hospitality sector has the lowest median age of any industry. At 31.8 years, today, Saru Jayamarman, president of One Fair Wage, says about half of surveyed service industry workers say they plan to quit in the next year. Jayaraman, is cautious in aligning this movement with that of white-collar workers, trading jobs for fun employment. That's one word. Maybe among white-collar workers, it's just people quietly resigning. But among service workers, they are organizing, she says. They are saying, I love this industry, but I will not come back unless there are permanent wage increases. Even though many cannot afford to stop working, she says, they have drawn a line in the sand, thanks to the light bulb moment of pandemic-precipitated challenges, accessing unemployment assistance, worsening income inequality, and newfound leverage due to staffing shortages. There's a distinction between the experiences of Ezimako and Green, but both are part of a broader societal shift, wherein young workers are prioritizing their self-worth. Now, for the first time in their careers, young people have the ability to do so. Workers like Green, who had well-paying jobs leading into the pandemic, have a greater sense of financial comfort after spending less and saving more during the past 19 months, says Harvard economist Lawrence Katz, that's K-A-T-Z. Plus, the abundance of open jobs may counterproductively make workers feel more confident dipping out of the workforce. Katz cautions that this is less about young workers leaving the labor market entirely, but instead about trying out new things and taking advantage of new opportunities and not sticking with the old bargain. The pivot to remote work has also made possible a level of work-life balance that those in their 20s and early 30s, the first generation where half of kids had two parents working full-time, had never imagined. That is especially true for millennials. A 2020 Gallup poll showed 74% did not want to return full-time to offices, the highest of any age cohort. Millennial women are particularly likely to stay home, given the need for childcare flexibility. Over 309,000 women dropped out of the workforce in September alone. Childcare is a piece that people have been underestimating for a while, says Alicia Sasser Modestino, an economist at Northeastern University. Even before the pandemic, it was a crisis now, with daycare center closures and, ironically, staff shortages for these very jobs. Women may have no choice but to stay home indefinitely. For others, remote work just is not fulfilling enough. When Emma Grace Moon quit her marketing agency job in June, she was ready to disentangle herself from a structure that held her back. I felt like I could exceed my trajectory way faster if it was in my hands, rather than reporting every year, every month, with a quarterly check-in. I felt like I could be making more and also growing way faster if I just did it myself, she says. These days, Moon, who is just 22, having skipped college, goes it alone as a consultant. She is making three times her former income, she says, from her Brooklyn apartment. Her area of expertise, working with direct-to-consumer brands, was primed for pandemic-era growth. She now also has the flexibility to travel and make her own hours, even if that often looks like working all the time instead of 9 to 5. Someone like Moon does not quite fit the typical understanding of the employment market in the U.S. As an independent worker, she is not filling an available job listing. But with 6 clients and counting, she is certainly not underemployed and does not see herself shifting back to working for someone else ever. It's allowed me a lot of time to think and process and make better decisions than I probably would if I had the pressure of a management team, she says. Plus, the anxiety of depending on others for income is long gone. I have had PTSD from past roles where I've seen people get fired out of the blue, or I've been fired before, she says, citing the instability of startups, where many white-collar, Gen Z, and millennial workers gravitate. The burnout of startup culture is common. Seattle-based engineer Corey Gabrielson, 30, quit his job as a second employee at an agriculture technology startup in April. The travel demands were intense. He spent 14-day stretches on site visits overseeing robotic farm equipment with requirements he calls pretty insane. After 2 years on the job, he was ready for time off. For several months after he quit, he says he did nothing, recovering from burnout. Now he spends his days option trading, running a Twitter bot account that tracks Ethereum pricing, and dabbling in Web3 and cryptocurrency investments. And while he would not describe himself as happier now, he misses the social interaction of an office. His mood is more neutral day to day, and he looks forward to building his presence as an independent entity who can do what he wants when he wants. I have no stress on the job compared to what I used to do, he says. He is not working full-time and has no concerns about money thanks to his savings, investments, and a boom in time in the crypto world. My goal is not to go back to having a boss, he says. Economists predict the Great Resignation is only getting started, especially for Gen Z and millennial workers, who are well-positioned to find new ways to earn income. A former colleague of Gabrielson's quit the same day he did and has since moved to Amsterdam. Moon and Green say many of their friends have sought advice on how to shift away from their 9-to-5s. Jayaraman warns that unless the restaurant industry introduces drastic changes, even more young service workers will choose their mental health over income. Without significant government investment in child care, young mothers will prioritize their families. Whatever their motivation, though, young blue-collar and white-collar workers alike are finding themselves happier and more independent. For Green, the change has helped kickstart her dream of a balanced, fulfilling career, which becomes more of a reality with every daily scoop of gelato. Raisa Bruner wrote this article with reporting by Mariah Espada. Now here's a short companion article, How Liz Shuler, S-H-U-L-E-R, new AFL-CIO chief, plans to seize Striketober. This is written by Amy Vasulis. As a vast labor shortage gives workers newfound leverage over their employers, the new president of the nation's largest labor union federation discusses the tens of thousands of workers seizing the opportunity to strike in October, dubbed Striketober for better benefits. Question. What has the transition to becoming president of AFL-CIO been like for you in the wake of Richard Trumka's unexpected death? Answer, it has been quite a responsibility to step into some big shoes and to keep this labor movement moving forward. We have such an opportunity in front of us, we cannot miss a beat. We have got this opportunity in Congress with all the investment poised to pass and create millions of good, well-paying jobs. And we have workers out in the streets taking risks and looking for change. Question. When you were elected, you said you were honored and ready to guide this federation forward. What does that mean in real terms? It means appealing to the next generation to show them they can see themselves in our labor movement and rising into leadership, making the change that they want in their workplaces and using the labor movement as a vehicle for that change. To show women and people of color that we make the difference in workplaces and close pay gaps. And that as technology is changing our workplaces and disrupting the business model, we would be the place to have a voice and a seat at the table. Question. Union membership rates continue to be highest among workers who are ages 45 to 64. What can unions do to recruit and retain younger Americans? Answer. This is the challenge of our time. Something like 10,000 people a day are retiring, and that silver tsunami is about to hit us. We are very much being intentional about engaging our young members. Having young people in leadership helps show other young people this labor movement is modern, dynamic, and is interested in caring about the things they care about. Question. Union membership is half of what it was in the 1980s. The PRO Act, which would create new protections for unionizing workers, is not likely to pass the Senate, and some of the country's largest companies are successfully squashing union drives. What gives you hope that Striketober is a turning point? Answer. When I walk the picket line with bakery workers, and I see their determination, their tenacity, their courage. That is what gives me hope. The PRO Act is very needed because our labor laws are so broken, it takes an act of absolute heroism to stand up and face down Goliath. We are going to keep fighting for the PRO Act, but we're also going to look for opportunities to get meaningful reforms in other vehicles that are moving. We want to make sure the penalties for employers who break the law are meaningful. We are working to try to make sure that gets passed in reconciliation. Time off opener. This is an essay. The Elusive Diana of the Imagination by Zephanie Sakarik. For a brief time, we knew her as Lady Di, and for a longer span as Princess Diana. But in the end, whether you loved or loathed what she stood for, no appellation felt adequate. By the time the former HRH, the Princess of Wales, died in a car crash in 1997, at age 36, she had become just Diana. One name with a complicated set of ambitions, joys, and disappointments folded within its petals. You can adore her or decry her as a wily social climber. The one thing you cannot do is stop looking at her. 24 years after her death, her specter is finding life everywhere, on TV, in the movies, and on Broadway. In our imaginations, at least, Diana is more alive than ever. She's also more mysterious, an enigma worthy of exploration, something many of us did not feel about her 10 or 20 years ago. For a long time, the tragic nature of her death aside, a terrible fate for any human being, it was easy to take her for granted, even to roll your eyes at her a little. As a royal, she looked fantastic in clothes, but didn't she also wear a pullover with little sheep knitted in? A fashion choice that pre-granny corps swerved a little too close to the jeering trend of the ugly Christmas sweater. And if the Diana story was in some way incredibly sad, her prince turned out to be a dud in the husband department, deeply in love with another woman the whole time. She was also canny enough to know how to play to her crowd. The shy die Prince Charles first courted, a nursery school helper with a habit of inclining her head such that her eyes were almost completely hidden by the blondish swoop of her bangs, later became a poised, polished young matron who publicly spilled royal secrets, avowing not so subtly that she had married into a family of monsters. Even if you had sympathy for her, the superstar victim routine could be distasteful. So, how should we feel today about Diana? The buffet of choices is so large that she can be almost anyone we want. In 2016, Chilean filmmaker Pablo Larraín released Jackie, starring Natalie Portman, an intimate fantasy portrait of Jacqueline Kennedy. Now with Spencer, Larraín attempts the same treatment for Diana, with Kristen Stewart as the tragic princess. Spencer takes place in December 1991. Over a dismal Christmas holiday at Sandringham, the royal family's country retreat, during which Diana decides to leave Prince Charles for good. But the movie feels less like a cry of the heart than a parody of a parody. Stewart's Diana is so unpleasantly self-centered, she'd be a terrible guest at any Christmas affair. She's late for every meal and complains endlessly that the family hates her and is trying to paint her as crazy. Meanwhile, she skulks about with her shoulders hitched to her ears, looking as if she's about to pocket some of the royal silverware. A title card at the movie's start informs us that Spencer is a fable from a true tragedy, and Larraín weaves in fairy tale elements like so many threads of lurex. Anne Boleyn makes a heavily symbolic appearance at the royal Christmas Eve dinner table, one unfortunate queen blinking a warning to a woman who seems headed for a similar fate. Stewart, generally a marvelous actor, plays Diana as a mannered doe. The performance is packed with calculation and guile. Larraín may be trying to dive into the satin and sadness psyche of a misunderstood and persecuted woman, but he inadvertently turns this Diana into exactly the thing the royal family accused the real-life Diana of being, a willful and pouty complainer, or worse, a megalomaniac. With friends like these, Diana doesn't need enemies. Spencer is heavily engineered to be one of those classy movies that wins awards, but the song and dance extravaganza, Diana the Musical, is a work Diana herself, known to be a fan of spectacles like the Phantom of the Opera, would more likely warm to. The show, with music and lyrics by David Bryan and Joe DiPietro, and a book by DiPietro, was set to open on Broadway in spring 2020 before the pandemic brought the curtain down. The live show will finally go on as planned in November. But there's a film version of the production available to watch right now on Netflix. Is Diana the musical any good? Not exactly. The early numbers especially, during the part of the show that details the meeting and courtship of the young Diana and her prince-to-be, are bright, cheerful, and chirpy. The show star, Gina DeWall, bursts onto the stage with a peppy princess number about being underestimated, which just happens to be called Underestimated. Your prison has been built, your downfall's been devised. Won't they be surprised when you're underestimated? The whole thing feels a bit self-helpy, cheerleaderish, but in a strange way, Diana the Musical, an effervescently pro-Diana entertainment that also acknowledges how much the young Diana craved the spotlight, only to be burned by it, is a more honest work than Spencer. There is nothing arty or arch about it. You can imagine Diana herself humming the songs, tickled to see her own reflection in them, and pleased as punch that she could inspire a Broadway show. Who wouldn't like that kind of fame, rendered in a sweet, harmless form, especially Diana, who was first made famous by photographers and then, years later, almost literally hounded to death by them. A Broadway musical, even a silly one, is not the worst memorial for a woman who came to be known as the people's princess. Yet of all these recent portrayals, it is Emma Corrin's, in the fourth season of Netflix's fiction-based, on-fact drama, The Crown, that comes closest to capturing Diana's opalescent mystery. Corrin's Diana first appears as a schoolgirl dressed as a tree sprite for a student production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Charles, Josh O'Connor, has come to the family home, Althorp, to pick up her older sister, Sarah, for a date. He spies the young Diana sneaking around in her tights, an awkwardly gammon adolescent who's trying not to be seen and yet clearly desperately wants to be seen, especially by a real-life prince. This scene is marvelous for the way it asks, without necessarily answering, had Diana been scheming from a young age her way into the royal palace? And then comes the kicker, so what if she had? It's common for young girls to yearn for fame, to dream of being acknowledged as charming and beautiful, to want to be seen. Corrin, so mischievous and flirty in those early scenes, helps us see that ambition in the very young Diana. But we also see how, just a few years later, that delight gives way to a particularly cruel disillusionment. In The Crown, days before the royal wedding, Diana discovers her fiancé has recently designed a gold bracelet as a farewell gift for his not really an ex, the married Camilla Parker Bowles. Though The Crown is fictional, this anecdote is essentially factual. The future princess sees she's been betrayed. She wants to back out of the marriage, but it is too late. The Crown shows the stricken bride in that puffy meringue of a wedding dress. Corrin's Diana looks so very small, as seen here. That dress, at the time a sigh-worthy symbol of fairy tale fantasy, may as well be a white wolf eating her alive. Young Diana Spencer got the prize she thought she wanted, and when she realized how hollow it was, she reinvented herself to fit into her strange, unhappy surroundings, and then reinvented herself again to get out. No wonder we have no idea who she really was. She died on her way to becoming that person, leaving behind a jumble of puzzle pieces that will never be an easy fit. Here is Time Off Television Review, He's Loved and He's Lost by Judy Berman. It's an old story. Just when you think you know where your life is heading, somebody comes along and shoves you off the path. One such transition shapes the smart second season of Love Life, an HBO Max anthology series that follows the romantic travails of a new character each season. This edition opens with Marcus Watkins, a married book editor played by William Jackson Harper, meeting his potential soulmate, Mia Hynes, Jessica Williams, at a wedding. Season 1 viewers will recognize Anna Kendrick's Darby as the bride. Small talk leads to an emotional affair that hastens the end of Marcus's marriage. Instead of hopping over to Mia's path, however, as he'd hoped, he's left lost in the woods, not just single, but also fundamentally confused as to who he is and what he wants. The scenario yields a far fresher story than Kendrick's generic single girl in the city tale. Like its predecessor, the season speeds through Marcus's entanglements at the rate of roughly one per episode. From the eager but inexperienced college girl, Aline Maya Goetia, to the older beauty who pays for fancy hotels, Leslie Bibb, but at its core is the identity crisis his feelings for Mia set into motion. A brainy guy who's tired of having to prove his authenticity to people, like a cocky young author he's courting who judge him for not being black enough and exhausted by white people who compare him to Obama. Marcus also has a strained relationship with his hard-to-please dad, John Earl Jilks. That tension does not seem at all unrelated to his struggle to define black masculinity on its own terms. As Mia drifts in and out of his life, hauling her own truckload of baggage, it is through introspection, experience, and accountability that Marcus approaches that elusive quality, maturity. Love Life is not the first rom-com to trace a character's emotional coming of age through successive relationships, but Harper's subtle, unaffected performance and the insight with which the people in his life are written and cast save it from the glibness of works like John Cusack's High Fidelity. Punky Johnson is a particular standout as Marcus's lady killer sister, Ida, while her Saturday Night Live castmate, Egal Nwandim, brings nuance to Ola, a woo-woo playwright girlfriend of Marcus's, who might have otherwise come off as a caricature. On-screen romance has evolved quite a bit since the Philadelphia Story, and even since Notting Hill. We've seen the genre diversify with movies like Crazy Rich Asians and shows like Insecure. The L word, looking, and the half of it have explored queer romance. Yet we still do not see many love stories that examine the difficulties a man, let alone a black man, might have to work through in forming an identity independent of his long-term partner. There's no male equivalent to Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. HBO's recent gender-flipped remake of Ingmar Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage felt forced. There are good reasons why finding oneself post-breakup has become an archetypally female narrative, even when we are not cutting ties with abusive partners. Women face a unique pressure to please, but women do not have a monopoly on identity crises. Whether he's putting up with his white boss's microaggressions or contorting himself to fit Ola's idealized conception of black love, the Marcus we meet lives largely on other people's terms. Only in interrogating everything about his life, his family, friendships, career, and his romantic relationships can he become a person who's ready for real love. As RuPaul might say, if you can't fulfill your own emotional needs, how the hell are you going to fulfill anyone else's? The Cow That Might Feed the Planet, by Aryn, A-R-Y-N, Baker, Maastricht, Netherlands. photographs by Ricardo Cassis for Time. The only photograph I will read to you is a full-page photograph without a caption of a beautiful reddish-brownish-blonde cow. Its head is being held in position by a hand, which looks like a male hand because of all the hair growing upon it, but one can never be sure. The cow standing in front of a very green area, green trees with a bit of blue sky peeking through, and green grass. We don't know the cow's name. There's no caption here. We don't know where the cow lives unless it comes to us later in the story. But I'm guessing it's a Guernsey because of her beautiful coloration. She has no horns, but she has a big brown eye. Remember, she's in profile because of the hand holding her head. And she also has an ear tag in her left ear, which would indicate she may be a registered Guernsey. So we will find out more about this elegant-looking cow in The Cow That Might Feed the Planet. The cows in Farmer John's pasture lead an idyllic life. They roam through tree-shaded meadows, tearing up mouthfuls of clover while nursing their calves in tranquility. Tawny brown, compact, and muscular, they are Limousin, Limousins, a breed known for the quality of its meat and much sought after by the high-end restaurants and butchers in the nearby food mecca of Maastricht in the southernmost province of the Netherlands. In a year or two, meat from these dozen cows could end up on the plates of Maastricht's better-known restaurants, but the cows themselves are not headed for the slaughterhouse. Instead, every few months, a veterinarian, equipped with little more than a topical anesthetic and a scalpel, will remove a peppercorn-sized sample of muscle from their flanks, stitch up the tiny incision, and send the cows back to their pasture. The biopsies, meanwhile, will be dropped off at a lab in a nondescript warehouse in Maastricht's industrial quarter, 5 miles away, where, when I visit in July, cellular biologist Joanna Melka is already working on samples sent in a few days prior. She swirls a flask full of a clear liquid flecked with white filaments, stem cells isolated from the biopsy, and fed on a nutrient-dense growth medium. In a few days, the filaments will thicken into tubes that look something like short strands of spaghetti. "This is fat," says Melka proudly. That's M-E-L-K-E. "Fat is really important. Without fat, meat does not taste as good." So on the opposite side of the building, other scientists are replicating the process with muscle cells. Like the fat filaments, the lean muscle cells will be transferred to large bioreactors, temperature and pressure-controlled steel vessels where, bathed in a nutrient broth optimized for cell multiplication, they will continue to grow. Once they finish the proliferation stage, the fat and the muscle tissue will be sieved out of their separate vats and reunited into a product resembling ground hamburger meat. With the exact same genetic code as the cows in Farmer John's pasture, the farmer is asked to go by his first name only in order to protect his cows and his farm from too much media attention. That final product, identical to the ground beef you are used to buying in the grocery store, in every way but for the fact that it was grown in a reactor instead of coming from a butchered cow, is the result of years of research and could help solve one of the biggest conundrums of our era: how to feed a growing global population without increasing the greenhouse gas emissions that are heating our planet past the point of sustainability. What we do to cows, it's terrible, says Melka, shaking her hand. What cows do to the planet when we farm them for meat, it's even worse. But people want to eat meat. this is how we solve the problem. When it comes to the importance of fat in the final product, Milka admits to a slight bias. She's a senior scientist on the fat team, a small group of specialists within the larger scientific ecosystem of MOSA, M-O-S-A, meat, the Maastricht-based startup whose founders introduced the first hamburger grown from stem cells to the world 8 years ago. That burger cost $330,000 to produce, and now Milka's fat team is working with the muscle team, the stem cell isolation team, and the scale team, among others, to bring what they call cell-cultivated meat to market at an affordable price. They're not the only ones. More than 70 other startups around the world are courting investors in a race to deliver lab-grown versions of beef, chicken, pork, duck, tuna, foie gras, shrimp, kangaroo, and even mouse for cat treats to market. Competition is fierce, and few companies have allowed journalists in for fear of risks to intellectual property. MOSA Meat granted time exclusive access to its labs and scientists so the process can be better understood by the general public. Livestock raised for food directly contributes 5.8% of the world's annual greenhouse gas emissions and up to 14.5% if feed production, processing, and transportation are included, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Industrial animal agriculture, particularly for beef, drives deforestation, and cows emit methane during digestion and nitrous oxide with their manure, greenhouse gases 25 and 298 times more potent than carbon dioxide, respectively, over a 100-year period. In 2019, the UN's International Panel on Climate Change issued a special report calling for a reduction in global meat consumption. The report found that reducing the use of fossil fuels alone would not be enough to keep planetary temperature averages from going beyond 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, at which point the floods, droughts, and forest fires we're already starting to see will negatively impact agriculture, reducing arable land while driving up costs. Yet global demand for meat is set to nearly double by 2050, according to the World Resources Institute, WRI, as growing economies in developing nations usher the poor into the meat-eating middle class. Growing meat in a bioreactor may seem like an expensive overcorrection when just reducing beef intake in high-consuming nations by 1.5 hamburgers per week per person could achieve significant climate gains, according to the WRI. But denying pleasure, even in the pursuit of a global good, is rarely an effective way to drive change. Earlier this year, the UN published the largest ever opinion poll on climate change, canvassing 1.2 million residents of 50 countries. Nearly two-thirds of the respondents view the issue as a global emergency. Nonetheless, few favored plant-based diets as a solution. For 50 years, climate activists, global health experts, and animal welfare groups have been begging people to eat less meat. But per capita consumption is higher than ever, says Bruce Friedrich, head of the Good Food Institute, a nonprofit organization promoting meat alternatives. The reason? It tastes too good, he says. Our bodies are programmed to crave the dense calories. Unfortunately, current production methods are devastating for our climate and biodiversity, so it is a steep price we're paying for these cravings. The best solution, says Friedrich, is meat alternatives that cost the same or less and taste the same or better. Milka and her fellow scientists at MOSA say they are getting very close. According to Mark Post, the Dutch scientist who midwifed the first lab-grown hamburger into existence, and who co-founded Mosa Meat in 2015, one half-gram biopsy of cow muscle could in theory create up to 4.4 billion pounds of beef, more than what Mexico consumes in a year. For the moment, however, Mosa Meat is aiming at 15,000 pounds, or 80,000 hamburgers per biopsy. Even by those modest metrics, Farmer John's little herd could supply about 10% of the Netherlands' annual beef consumption. Eventually, says Post, we would need only some 30,000 to 40,000 cows worldwide, instead of the 300 million we slaughter every year. Without the environmental and moral consequences of large-scale intensive cattle farming. I admire vegetarians and vegans who are disciplined enough to take action on their principles, says Post, but I can't give up meat, and most people are like me. So I wanted to make the choice for those people easier to be able to keep on eating meat without all the negative externalities. I will now begin to abridge this lengthy article and returning to the text. When Austrian food trends analyst Hani Rutzler appeared on stage to taste Mark Post's burger at its public debut in London, August 5, 2013, her biggest fear was that it might taste so bad she'd spit it out on the live video broadcast. But once the burger started sizzling in the pan and the familiar scent of browning meat hit her nose, she relaxed. It was closer to the original than I even expected, she says. At the tasting, she pronounced it close to meat, but not that juicy. That was to be expected, says Mosa co-founder, COO, and food technologist Peter Verstrata. The burger was 100% lean meat, and without fat, burgers don't work. In fact, without fat, he says, you would be hard-pressed to tell the difference between a piece of beef and a cut of lamb. Fat is not necessarily harder to create than muscle. It's just that, as with protein cells, getting the process right is time-consuming. And Verstrata and Post prioritized protein. The technology itself is relatively straightforward and has been used for years in the pharmaceutical industry to manufacture insulin from pig pancreases. Identify and isolate the stem cells, the chameleon-like building blocks of animal biology. Prod them to create the desired tissue, then encourage them to proliferate by feeding them a cell culture medium made up of amino acids, sugars, salts, lipids, and growth factors. Scientists have been trying for years to use the same process to grow artificial organs, arteries, and blood vessels with mixed results. Post, a vascular cardiologist, used to be one of those scientists. He jokes that stem cell meat, unlike organs, does not have to function. On the other hand, it has to be produced in massive amounts at a reasonable cost. And pharmaceutical companies have spent decades and billions of dollars attempting, and largely failing, to scale up stem cell production to a fraction of what it would take to make cultivated meat affordable. If cellular agriculture companies succeed, where so many others have failed, it could unlock a completely new way of feeding human beings, as radical a transformation as the shift from hunting to domesticating animals was thousands of years ago. Despite investor enthusiasm, that is still a big if. Eat Just, the company closest to market, is producing only a couple hundred pounds of cultivated chicken a year. For all the successes that cultivated meat companies have broadcast over the past few years, biotechnologist Ricardo San Martin, research director for the UC Berkeley Alternative Meats Lab, is skeptical that lab bench triumphs will translate into mass market sales anytime soon, if at all. Not one of the companies currently courting investment has proved it can manufacture products at scale, he says. They bring in all the investors and say, here's our chicken. And yes, it is really chicken, because there are chicken cells, but not very many, and not enough for the market. The skepticism is justified. Very few people outside of Israel and Singapore have actually been able to try cultivated meat. Citing a pending EU regulatory filing, Mosa declined to let Time try its burger. Eat Just offered a tasting but would not allow access to its labs. And the rollout of Eat Just's chicken nuggets in Singapore raises as many questions as it answers. At the moment, the cost to produce cultivated meat hovers around $50 a pound, according to Michael Dent, a senior technology analyst at market research company ID Tech X. Eat Just, that's two words, Eat Just's three-nugget portion costs about $17, or 10 times as much as the local McDonald's equivalent. CEO Josh Tetrick admits the company is losing a lot on every sale, but argues the current production cost per pound is just not relevant. At this point, says Dent, making a profit is not the point. It is not in itself a viable product, but it's been very, very successful at getting people talking about cultured meat. And it's been very successful in getting Eat Just another round of investments. But for those in the $386 billion a year cow business, a battle's brewing. As production moves from feedlot to factory, cattle ranchers stand to lose both jobs and investments. Like coal country in the era of clean energy, entire communities are at risk of being left behind, and they will fight. The cattle industry will do everything they can to call lab-grown meat into question, because once it breaks through to grocery stores, they're competing on basic stuff like taste and price, and they know they won't be able to win. The U.S. Cattlemen's Association has already petitioned the U.S. Department of Agriculture to limit the use of terms beef and meat exclusively to products derived from the flesh of a bovine animal, harvested in the traditional manner. A decision's pending. But if it comes down in the favor of the cattle industry, it could create a significant barrier to market adoption of cell-cultured meat, says Dent. For a new product that consumers do not know and do not trust, the terms you can use make a critical difference. Who's going to buy something called lab-grown cell protein isolates? It's meat, says Tetrick. Even down to the genetic level, it is meat. It's just made in a different way. Tetrick, who won a similar naming battle in 2015, when his company, then known as Hampton Creek, successfully maintained the right to call its eggless mayonnaise substitute Just Mayo, says the U.S. Cattlemen's Association's complaints is as senseless as if the U.S. automotive industry had argued that Tesla could not use the word car to describe its electric vehicles, on the basis they lacked an internal combustion engine. Still, he says, naming is critically important. As the technology has gathered speed over the past several years, terms including cell-cultured, cultivated, slaughter-free, cell-based, clean, lab-grown, and synthetic have been variously used, but consensus is gathering around cultivated meat, which is Tetrick's term of choice. Verstrata at Moza is ambivalent. Ultimately, we're going to produce a hamburger that's delicious. We can call it meat or we can call it Joe. But if a meat lover consumes it and has the same experience as when consumers buying a great Wagyu burger, then we're good to go. There's a photograph here to share. It appears to be set in a very clean white room with a tiled floor. There's a red cabinet on one wall next to a red fire extinguisher, and leaning on that cabinet is a man with graying hair, dark blue shirt, tan pants, and brown shoes. Seated in rather modern-looking office chairs are two other men. One has brown hair, a dark blue shirt, and blue jeans, and is wearing gold-colored sneakers. And the other is slightly balded with, I would say, a gray-haired crew cut, a light blue short-sleeved shirt, beige trousers, and is wearing gray sneakers. There is there's something either on the wall or superimposed upon it by the photographer or editor of Time. It says, pioneering a leaner, kinder way making beef. And there's probably an of there hidden behind the man with the dark blue, one of the men with the dark blue shirt. The MOSA team is the caption. From left, Peter Verstrata, co-founder and chief operating officer, Martin Bosch, CEO, Mark Post, chief scientific officer, at their headquarters in Maastricht, Netherlands, in July. There's a bit of a graph here shown on the next couple of pages. It says carbon conscious. Central banks are getting more involved in combating climate change. Here's how their policies flow through the broader financial system and economy. Central banks are evaluating their own climate risks. Some are actively decarbonizing their own portfolios by, for instance, buying green bonds and accepting them as loan collateral, and calling upon financial institutions to do the same. Central banks are running stress tests with different climate scenarios to see how resilient the financial system is to climate shocks. As regulators get better at measuring and assessing risk, they may eventually require lenders to hold more capital to cover their risks. These actions could transform investment. Investors may shy away from big emitters. Some banks offer interest rates pegged to companies' climate targets. Companies pursuing greener projects could have an easier time raising money in the lending and capital markets. To help curb climate change, the financial system will be more resilient to climate disasters and be better prepared for the transition to a net zero economy. And more green investment will decarbonize the economy, which will ultimately help prevent climate disasters. The graphic is based on reporting by Emily Barone with input from Natalia Ospina, David Barnes, and Megan Green. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.